Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with 1 year or more of sobriety, tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight we have Isla, Running Deer, T.F. as our speaker, and she has broken out her NAVA Club 50th anniversary t-shirt. The first time she has worn it is a winner. She's been saving it for this occasion. We're so happy that she's going to be our speaker. I can tell by all the happy, smiling faces. So I'm just going to turn it over to this lady, and you're in good hands.
Tim, thank you. My name is Isla, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be sober today. And I'm so glad that you're here sober today, because God works through people. And the ones who drug me along at the beginning are mostly, they're mostly gone to that big meeting in the sky. So today I've been blessed with you. And Kelly, I'm so glad you came. You don't normally come to this meeting. I'm so happy to see you. All of you, thank you. My sobriety date is October 24 of 89. I'm a member of the 130 Think It Through Sober Group. And the most important date, there are two very, very important dates in my life. And one of those most important dates is April 3rd, 1975, which is not my sobriety date, but it was the day that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and NAVA. And I don't pick up a chip for that date, but that is the day that my life changed. And even though I drank again in 89 after 2 weeks shy of 14 years, the day that I celebrate, there's two of them. The day I met my son and the day that my life changed because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was at NAVA. But I'm going to go back. The last time I told my story, I was so scattered that I swore I would never do it again. But, you know, I take comfort in knowing that I couldn't be worse, that I do a worse job than I did the last time. And what I have done, I'm going to try to go through this chronologically, because there are huge, huge portions of my childhood that I simply don't remember. I mean, years that I simply don't remember. And then when I started drinking at age 18, I was a blackout drinker from the beginning. So there are really a lot of gaps in what I can put together. But I do know, and I've got lots of notes, I was born into an alcoholic home But it was a sharecropper's shack. And this was December 27, 1943, when I was born. I used to tell people that the reason my personality was so warped was because it was because of all that Merry Christmas and Happy Birthday shit, right? But it was a shack. It did not have indoor plumbing. And one of the most horrific memories that I can remember, but it's a good way to let you know of what it was like, is I was probably 6 years old, and I was out. I'm the seventh of eight children. Had five older brothers, one older sister, and then later my baby sister Jan was born when I was about seven. And I was probably about six at this time, and I was out on the toilet. And you don't sit in an outhouse. You squat. You climb up there and squat. You know what I'm talking about, Jenny? You're acting as if you might know what I'm talking about. And I hope yours was better kept, but there was like a million maggots at the bottom, and the stench was unbelievable. And I was about six, and I was always terrified that I would fall through. But I was sitting there, and something came out of my little butt, and it was long, and it was white, and it was alive. And I started screaming, and my sweetest brother, even though he didn't live there anymore, he came. And here he is. He's Seaburn. He was my sweetest brother. And he heard me screaming, and he came with two sticks and pulled it out and threw it down there among the millions of maggots. And do you know that was never mentioned? Nothing was ever talked about in my household. It was scoffed at. It was made fun of. And we didn't talk about anything important. Never. And so that was it, you know. And it was caused, I learned as an adult, from eating contaminated food. And it was a tapeworm. I was a very skinny, pitifully shy little kid, and started at school at five, and I knew nothing. And I started at five only because of when my birthday fell. But every day at recess, I would beg my sister Audrey. Audrey was the closest thing to a mother I had, because Daddy was alcoholic, but it was periodic, and I guess it was like when the crops were brought in, blah, blah, blah. And we would make one order of the Sears Roebuck catalog, and then once a year, and then that catalog would go to the outhouse. And there were no books in the house, but I felt so ashamed, because I knew that everybody didn't live well, and there was never enough food, and it was extreme deprivation. And then when my little sister came along, but I'm skipping ahead of myself. As I said at the beginning, God works through people and dogs. But there were always just enough people to get me through no matter what. You know, before I got to AA, I had all of you. But In the meantime, I always had enough people. And I had an Aunt Maddie. And I think everybody hopefully had an Aunt Maddie. And I would go stay with her a week in the summertime. And on her dinner table, it was a feast. There would be not one meat. There would be pork, chicken, and beef, and about 1,000 fresh vegetables. And I would eat until I would throw up. And my Aunt Maddie loved me. And I knew that she did because she would make me a brand new dress out of a flour sack. And not only was it a new dress made especially for me, it always had some rickrack or some buttons or something very special. And there was also the visit from my brother. My oldest brother, my brothers escaped as soon as they could through the U.S. Army. And my oldest brother, Cecil, came to town. Again, I was about 6. And he came home. He had re-enlisted. He was a non-commissioned officer. And he had come to town. And actually, this is really my only memory of him. And the next time that I saw him was in a coffin. But I'm jumping ahead of this wonderful story. When he came home, he looked at me and he said, "Are those your best shoes?" And I said, "What? They're my only shoes." And my brother Cecil took me to town, which was Scottsboro, Alabama, up in the northeast corner. And bought me new shoes. And I was so happy to be walking and holding the hand of this gorgeous, tall soldier in his uniform. One of the best memories ever. And I knew about hard work because I worked in the fields picking cotton and doing all that stuff and missing a lot of school. And So I knew about hard work, I knew about shame, and I knew deprivation. And I have heard a lot of people talk about how they were so poor when they were little, but they didn't know it. I knew it. And hard work was valued above all else, and the shame that I felt. Because not only were we so poor, and then Daddy would be drunk and violent, and it was a rough childhood. And then when my little sister came along, I learned about responsibility. As I said, I was about 7 when she was born, and I became her primary caretaker, just like Audrey, even though Mama worked really, really hard. At the house and in the field, she always had some menial job outside too. So Audrey raised me, and basically I raised my little sister Jen's. And did I say that she had Down syndrome? And she was the love of my life, and I had a sister-in-law who took care of her after my mama died, and she said she couldn't remember me as a little kid without Jan on my hip. But when it had to be, I was born in 43, and the oldest brother was killed, Cecil, in the Korean War, and it had to be from 50 to 53, and I'm not sure about the time. Because those are the dates of the war. And his body was escorted home by his younger brother by 1 year, Hubert. And we had a military funeral, and it was the most beautiful, impressive thing I'd ever seen at that point. And because of his giving his all, Mama was the beneficiary. And I think it was $10,000 that the government put on my brother's life. And, you know, in those days, you could buy a house for $10,000. And they did. So my junior high school was much, much better because we had a house with indoor plumbing, and it was two-story, and it had a huge bathroom. And so things were better financially, and it was just better. As I said, I have, it was when we had moved into that house that, I must have been about time for me to go into junior high. And as there was no religion, I mean, nothing important was ever talked about. It was scoffed at and laughed at. And I learned very, very early to pretend that I didn't care anyway. It didn't matter to me. I was tough. I was hard. I didn't care. And I cared deeply, of course. In junior high school, I also had Hilda Fears was doing God's work. She was a history teacher and quite the character, but she saw me. And I know you know how important that is for a teacher to see you. And I was also seen by my English teacher, whose name I can't remember, but he was probably the first man I'd ever met who had clean fingernails. You know, I'm talking about rough living. And that home was lost in my junior year in high school because Mama was a good money manager, Daddy was not. So when I graduated high school, we were back in a rental house. In high school, I was probably 13 before I really looked up. But when I learned to read, that is something to this day that I put on gratitude lists. I can read, and that changed my life and my world. And I felt very, very different. I was, you know, children can be cruel, so that added to the roughness of the elementary school. But it's almost 9 o'clock, and I'm still in elementary school. Oh Lord! High school. If I wanted any money, I would still have to quote hire out, but I didn't have to work our own fields for the landowner. And the students in junior and senior high school, they were kind. They never teased me about my ill-fitting, hand-me-down clothes. They did everything in their power. Like when we had a band, and of course me having and playing an instrument was not even to be thought about because that cost money. So they made me the flag carrier, and that uniform was furnished. And then also in high school, I had a very Sally Field moment when they a popular vote voted me the senior class beauty. But instead of thanking them and telling them how happy they had made me, I went in the bathroom. I didn't thank anybody. I went in the bathroom and cried because, you know, they like me. They really do. But I didn't express that because I didn't know how to express important things. Now, you know, I've always had kind of, I could always bullshit with you, you know, before or after a meeting, but no. So when I graduated high school, I didn't know it at the time, but I was pregnant. There was this guy named Carl who was 5 or 6 years my senior. I thought that I was in love with him. I was a virgin at 17. And when I found out that I was pregnant, he had moved on. And I learned later somebody else was pregnant too. And I was on my own. So it was, and I knew about work, and I got a job. I had come to Atlanta to break the news to him. I'd gotten a ride with somebody, and so I knew about hard work, and immediately when I knew that he was having none of it, it was total abandonment. I got a job with what used to be Southern Bell as a telephone operator, but I was sick. I mean, physically throwing up sick the whole 9 months, and I'm sure that was probably as much psychological as it was physical. But when I was going, I don't know what I thought I was going to do, but I knew I'd have to have a job. So, but I got sick on the bus and had to get off the bus and go throw up. And I wrote a letter to my brother Billy. He was the one that I really grew up with. He was about 3 years. He was only 20. When I think about it, he was only about 20. And it was 59 years ago today that Billy drove from Chicago and took me back to Chicago with him. And he and his, at that time, wife Pauline lived on South Halsted. And I don't know if you know, but that's a bad, bad part of town. And it was a furnished third-story walk-up. And I slept on their couch. And I turned 18 on December 27th. And my son was born January 5th, so I was just legal to sign the papers. And I know you're all asking what's this got to do with alcoholism, because at that point, I had never had a drink because I did not want to be like my daddy, like my brothers, like my cousins, like my older sister. I didn't want to be like that. And somehow intuitively, I knew that if I drank, I would be exactly like them. And so I did not drink until when I came back to Alabama shortly after I had signed the adoption papers. Mom and Daddy had moved to an even lesser place in the back of a service station where they lived. And I was in the bedroom crying, and it was really open. And my little sister, Janice, I heard her say to Mama, "Mama, I was crying." And Mama said, "Well, just cry." And I think, I'm not sure, but that's the last time I remember crying until I had been in AA about 3 or 4 months, and I finally, my heart had started to thaw. The nearest place to get a job was Chattanooga, Tennessee, so I went to Chattanooga, Tennessee about a week after returning, and it was still January, and I lived at YWCA and got a job at Signal Knitting Mills, and I hated that, and so I left one day, and I knocked on doors, and I got a job at one of those small loan companies, just a hole-in-the-wall kind of place. And it was an office job, and I learned I hated that too, but it was an office job, and I didn't have oil on my glasses and in my hair from sewing up the feet of pajamas, so I thought that was a step up. And I worked there. That was where I learned to drink, was at the loan office place. And the very first night, and I think at this point, I think there was had been so much pain. There had been so much shame that it just didn't matter. And I started drinking in earnest because, again, I had just turned 18 and blackouts already. And then I got fired from that job and I had been thrown out. This all happened in 2 years between Mark's birth, my son's birth, and Eastern Airlines. It was 2 years. There were three jobs. I had been evicted from the YWCA for drinking. I had been evicted from the next place, which was the Young Women's Christian Temperance Association. And generally, there was a man involved. I know there was in that instance. So on the third job, I was living, which was with a paper company, and I was living with my sister Audrey and her husband, and their children had moved to Chattanooga, and I was living with them. So I would do anything to get out of this job, and there were the people who saved me at the job was Marie and Mark, who owned the place, and he was a mentor. And he had also loaned me money to go to Eastern Airlines training school. And how I got there was I had quit the job at the paper company because I hated it. But I would go, I would do anything to get out of the office. So I would take Mark to the airport. And Mark would, at that time they would let you go on the plane and blah, blah, blah. And all the security wasn't available at that time. So I had quit my job at the paper company, and then I was reading this paper that they were hiring stewardesses, as they were commonly called back in the day, though the company always called us flight attendants. So my first flight was from Chattanooga to Miami for my second interview. And that was a whole other world. And I loved the freedom. I loved not being stuck in a field or an office. And people, and the trouble with trouble is that it starts out being fun, right? And I was drinking like crazy, but it seemed like everybody was. And I'm going to jump back to Tennessee for just a minute, but Marie had made me, because I couldn't say no to her any more than I can say no to Tim. Marie had made me be in a Miss Chattanooga pageant, and it was 18 or 19, and I don't remember which. I think it was 19. I was 19 years old. And she had a daughter who was going to be in that. And at the finals, the women that I lived with at the Women's Christian Temperance Association before I got kicked out, they had promised to bring me whiskey backstage before the finals, and they didn't. And I think that to this day is why I'm so terrified of being on stage. I was horribly unprepared. I was unrehearsed, and I was just frozen. And I know, looking back and trying to get this in some semblance of order, I was within a year psychologically dependent on alcohol. So I loved the new life. I loved that uniform, which was Don Loper Don't get me started on clothes. But he was the designer of the day. And that uniform cost more money than I had been spent on my wardrobe in my whole entire life. And I had probably the first physical I'd ever had in my entire life. And I learned that I was still anemic and malnourished from being a kid. Okay, so that was fun. That was a lot of fun in the beginning. And then what we used to do was, and I got married when I was 24. I was 24, and so was he. And that marriage lasted for 3 years. It was, and he, I got an emergency transfer. I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up. I got an emergency transfer to Atlanta after 3 years of marriage because in those days they had real life crew schedulers, not just a computer, and they had seen my vain attempts to hide my black eyes and stuff like that. And I was a drunk. And we were both terribly emotionally immature. But it was actually his mother, before we got married, was the first one. I was age 23 when I met her. She was the first one. He came from a very affluent, wealthy family. And she was the first one to say, I don't want you to marry my son. She said, A, you're not Catholic. B, you don't want children. And you have a drinking problem. She was the first one to say it to my face. And I couldn't deny it. I knew she was true. So, Eddie was on my amends list because I broke his heart with my drinking. And I'll go, if time allows, I'll go. So I got the emergency transfer in 1971 to transfer from D.C. to Atlanta. And I went out on a 4-day trip and I got back to Washington. The National, and I left with my suitcase and my car and my emergency transfer, and I drove to Atlanta. And that was 1971. And that was the same year my daddy died. And on the drive, I didn't stop except to go to the bathroom and get gas. And I felt like a failure. I felt nobody would ever love me again. I would never love anybody again. And I had failed at marriage. And that was when the drinking really got serious. And that was when, the only time in my life I've ever been promiscuous, but I was promiscuous, I was looking for somebody to help me make it through the night. If y'all remember that song. And it was 74, it had to be 74, that I had 2 DUIs. They let me go a long time. They said, let me go. They would say, go home, blah, 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 blah. But when I got that first DUI, it wasn't 3 months until I got the second one. And I am so grateful today. I'll tell you that I didn't have a DUI. That I didn't kill anybody. And that last one, when I came to, I had a roommate named Joan who drank, quote, the same way I did. And she also came with me to my, she was the one who always got me out of jail. And that last one, they had put me in solitary confinement, and it was in Fulton County, making DeKalb look like a picnic in comparison. When I came to, I got out of jail that morning, and what I learned was they didn't have cell phones then. And this one woman, and I was the only white person in the pen, right? And this one woman kept talking on the phone. And I went over to her, and I yanked it out of her hand because I had a bad headache, and I was withdrawing, and I didn't have good sense. And it was the only time in my life, I think, it was like I felt I wanted to fight. But there was a guard, a woman, who knew in retrospect that if she didn't get me out of there, those women would either kill me or hurt me very badly. And so I was taken to what I later learned, it was the coldest place I've ever been. Put me in a uniform, and it wasn't a cell they put me in. It was not much bigger than a phone booth. There was no toilet. There was no bath. And it was so cold, I thought I would die. And I learned later that they called us the icebox, and that's where they put people who were withdrawing and under arrest. And I'm so grateful that most of my foolishness happened before everybody had a cell phone. But when I remember getting out of jail that morning, and there was a line of men, and there was a line of women, and some, I guess he was a cutie, I don't remember, but he mouthed me, "What do you like to drink?" "Scotch." I left with that man, who I couldn't identify if he was one of you, and that's all I remember, except when I came to at about 3 a.m. the following morning, I guess 24 hours plus had passed, and I came to and I was the only person in that big house, and I knew that Joan's parents had been visiting from Thomaston. So we put this off, but when I came to in that house, and not knowing again what had happened, and that was, I think that was one of the moments that got me to ask for help. Because I knew I was an alcoholic, and I had tried to quit drinking, and I could not. I had tried all the books. And so what I learned is that the only reason they came and took him, whoever he might be, back to jail, and the only reason they didn't take me back was because Joan's parents begged the cops, "Don't take her. She lives here." I always had people in my life to help me, and I didn't realize it until... Well, I realize it today, and you're it. So I don't remember. I do remember at age 28 calling Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, "What's your name and where do you live?" And I very quickly hung up, and I'm saying, "I thought this was an anonymous program." I know now that they were probably going to try and direct me to a meeting. But that was when I started praying. And I called myself agnostic because at about age 12, I had gone to church one day. And, of course, it was a Baptist church. And because I doubted what that man was saying, I guess I thought that made me an agnostic. But looking back over the years, I know I never was agnostic. Because, as it says on certain page about, we always had this idea of God, no matter what, and we always found that in the final analysis, we found God deep down within, because in the last analysis, it's only there that he can be found. Well, I was praying because I had reached the point I used to have a great, great tolerance, and then I had no tolerance. And then I could maybe drink a glass of wine and I'd be drunk, and then I would drink a fifth of scotch, and I so desperately wanted oblivion, and I couldn't get there either. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober. And at this point, I lived alone. I still had a job, not because I hadn't been caught drinking on the job. I remember, as I said, the first time when I was psychologically dependent on alcohol, I was 18 or 19. And then I remember being on the airplane. I was based in Atlanta, so I know it was after 71. And I can remember I was working the senior position. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And as senior, I was working first class. And I looked around at all of the coffee cups, and they were, I'd served breakfast. This was like leg number three. And I saw all those coffee cups were empty, and people wanted me to fill the coffee cups and take our trays, right? But I stood there, and my hands were shaking so badly, I knew that I could not. So I had reached a total state of physical and psychological dependence on alcohol. And what started out as fun, like mixing a big water pitcher full of Bloody Marys, and the whole crew, the cabin crew, not the cockpit. But it started out being fun, but then for years, I drank on the job because I had to. And sometimes it would be in a hotel room before checking in for a flight, but I couldn't count on that. And very often it would be in a paper cup. So this went on. I was never a social drinker. I went straight from what I had feared, from being a teetotaler to, in 6 years, I was, you know, I knew I was alcoholic. And I didn't really start trying to get sober. I mean, willing to go to any length with the kind that requires, you know, it says, no human could have relieved our alcoholism. It's true in my case. And I started to pray. And at this point, people who drank like me didn't want anything to do with me because I was an embarrassment. And I'd be in a blackout, and I didn't remember. But the last roommate I had before coming into AA, Pam Mellish was her name, she told me one morning before I moved out, again, it was probably, I don't remember under what circumstances we parted ways, but by this time I've been asked to leave every place I'd ever lived, and it was about 3 months after starting to pray that prayer, just, dear God, please help me stop drinking. The phone rang, and it was Pam Mellish. And she had gone to Al-Anon trying to help her mother, had failed at that. But that phone call, the God that I understand is very, very pragmatic and works through people. And it was Pam. And she said, and if you're afraid to go, I'll go with you. But I knew who I wanted to go and with me, and that was Joan. You know, my old drinking buddy, my old roommate, they all get me out of jail. And I said, yes, I'll go. And I called Joan. We had an appointment. My very first AA meeting was at NABA, April 3rd of 1975. And it was a women's meeting, and they were talking about the big book, and I thought they were talking about the Bible, and I didn't care. I was going for it. I saw women who were sober. I didn't know anything about sobriety, but I knew that they were sober, that they did not drink, and no matter, I was so willing. I think it says in the book that I was as willing as only the dying can be. And I, in my heart, very much like you, James, in my heart, I was, the steps, yes, I'm willing, I'm open, and I will be honest. And I kind of grabbed on to the principles before I had actually, quote, formally done the steps, and it kind of took me a while to get them synced up and say, oh, that's what I did. That's what I did. I knew immediately I was an alcoholic, and I was honest about that. So that's step one, and I was willing to go to any lengths to do whatever it took. And I got hope, which is the one-word character for step two. I got that at the very first meeting, and that turned my life from black and white to technicolor. And I really kind of got slowed down on step three because, again, I didn't know what God wanted from me, but I knew it was going to be something I didn't want to do. So, again, I hadn't been able to do step four yet, though I was writing, and I had already made some emergency amends, like after just 6 months. It included a check to that man who had helped me, who had paid for my, it was a loan, paid for my Eastern Airlines training school, $300, when that was a lot of money. I'd never paid him back. I wrote a check and a letter. And I had also sent a check and a letter to my brother, who took care of me when I was in Chicago. And I honed in on the, if I tried my best to practice all of these principles, then my, probably I'm not practicing my character defects. I went to lots of meetings. I glommed on to step 10 immediately, and by the time I got around to actually doing, you know, they say if you're really hung up on a step, go to the one before it. So I went back to step 3, and I, quote, needed, I wanted so badly to do it right, and to just do it, and I wanted to do it formally with a man of the cloth or a woman of the cloth. So I'd gone to a spiritual retreat. Now I had Linda Mitchell, Linda Green, who was at my very first AA meeting. I had Barbara Key. We were tight as thick as thieves. And Cheryl and Peggy, my sponsor. I had my posse, and they were all like, would I have done it without them? It's the people. It is always the people. The literature is wonderful. The steps are wonderful. But without the people to hold me and guide me and befriend me and was taught by... So, okay, I'm running ahead of myself and getting all flustered because it's time to close and I'm not ready. I wanted to, the most important things are the steps. But step 10, doing that for the long 18 months before I did all of it, was, by now, my immediate past is not so bad. And the fellowship was no longer enough. You saying hello to me was no longer enough, and inviting me for coffee was no longer enough. So I had gone on this spiritual retreat with Cheryl and some of my posse, some of the women in the meetings, and I said to the man, I would like to do a step three with you. And he said, you mean step five, don't you? And I said, no, I mean three. So we did a formal one, and that gave me, and I asked, what, God, what if I have to give up? Am I willing to give up whatever it is? And at that time, it was a young man. And I said, if you want me to give up Kim, am I willing to do it? And it was yes. If that's what it takes for me to stay sober, then I will do that. And then I had the courage, after doing that formal, doing it right, I had the courage to go ahead and do step four and five and six and seven. And all of them, today, I mean, anytime you ever want to talk about it, one thing at a time, I'm trying to do too much. But I stayed happily sober for just shy of 14 years. And what happened? Well, there's a lot of alibis. We were on strike at Eastern Airlines. I had all of this spare time. I'd never had spare time on my hands. I'd always worked. Those are just excuses. But what I do remember, that a friend in Bobby Stanfield, he won't mind me saying this, I don't think, still sober today. Yes, it is time. But if I have a drink, if I do any drug, I will return to the drug of my choice. I had already done other drugs, and I returned to the drug of my choice. And in a nutshell, I had gotten disconnected from you. And staying sober today was no longer my primary purpose. It was a lot of other things, and that was not among them. And it has to be number one. And so when I came back and got my, actually it was my first white chip, because the first time I didn't get one. I just got the red one and blah, blah, blah. But I am so grateful. And I have found that the more grateful I am, the more I have for which to be grateful. So you won't be surprised to learn that on Valentine's Day, 1997, I met my son and my four grandchildren. And I didn't even tell you about, there's always been people in AA. There has always been, from the death of my sister Audrey when I had about 3 years, the emergency contact that Eastern Airlines had was NAVA. And T.C. Henderson picked up the phone, and he was the one. And I, instead of being, I just, on the way from the airport, I was to home where T.C. met me. I was just praying, God, whatever it is, give me the strength. Give me the strength to bear it. And I've never been anonymous, and it served me well. It helped a judge give me custody of their youngest, my sister's youngest child, Jean. She was 11 when her parents died, that tragic alcoholic death. And the judge told the couple who also wanted her, I would rather see her grow up in a drug-free home than to have two parent roles. So next April, I'm going to be a great grandmother, and I am so grateful to know my family, to know who they are, and to be a part of their family. And I am just so grateful today to be sober, and that you are too, because one thing I know for sure, I can't do this by myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Isla. And I speak for everybody. We're so glad you're part of our family. And I'm going to unmute people for a moment before we hand out the chips. because I know folks want to say a couple of things to you.
Mind blowing, Isla. Beautiful story.
And it helps me so much, Isla. Thank you so much for your words and your life.
Thank you, Isla.
You had me at the outhouse, Isla. I was captivated already.
Hey, I've been in the outhouse. Understand?
Who said that?
I did, Isla. Brad.
Brad. Brad.
I meant
to get sober like 30 minutes ago. I really did.
Hey, you got sober in 89. You did good. You did good.
Parents had it.
And virtually, you touched all of us, Isla.
Very brave lady, Isla. Love you. Just a beautiful story.
Thank you, Isla.
Thank you, Isla. Beautiful, beautiful, Isla.
Thank you, Isla. I love you very much. You are such a beautiful person, and I mean that. You almost made me cry. I like you. I really do, and I'm so proud to know you. I really am. Thank you, honey.
Thank you,
Isla. That was great. Appreciate you telling your story.
Thank you, David.
Isla, nobody would believe with all that poise and grace that you have, that you've climbed the mountain that you have, and I'm just glad that you're on top of Victory Mountain.
Eastern Airlines changed your life, Isla.
Yeah. It's the best education. You know, there was no money for that trip, that senior class trip to D.C. And who knew I'd be living there?
And I've seen a room. I've seen her in uniform. She did it well.
Well, I wanted to share this with you because, again, I really wanted not for it to be a drunk of what it was like. But when I had 1 year sober, I took a realtor to Napa. Talk about commitment. And I said, I want to buy a house within a six-mile radius. And I bought a house. It was 2 miles away, and by this time, a year, I knew that there was plenty of other problems I had other than alcohol. So I made that commitment to buy that house, and we had a lot of good parties there, didn't we, Brad?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
And again, I wasn't worried because, you know, you were the family I always was looking that I really didn't have. And not only that, everybody shared their family with me. Remember, Barbara and her girls were still friends today. And Linda Mitchell, her parents and siblings took me in. I mean, I'm committed for life. And I hope and pray that I never again think that I don't need to stay connected to you. Yeah. So far, so good.
So go ahead, Cleo.
All righty. Hey, family. My name is Cleo, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cleo.
Hey, thank you so much, Isla, for sharing your life story with us. Tonight is such an important, meaningful life, and I'm very grateful for it. So for the first step, we have the white step. That's for 24 hours for those that would like to join us on a new journey and new way of life. Uh-uh. And the next chip is the silver chip for 30 days. And the next chip is the gold chip for 60 days. Alrighty, looks like we all have a little bit of time. And the next chip is the red chip for 3 months. Let's see, we have the yellow chip for 6 months and the green chip for 9 months. And this next chip goes to someone that has not only touched and lightened my life, not only as a sponsor but as a very good friend. This one goes to Kelly for her 15th birthday, AA birthday. And Kelly has been so instrumental with my sobriety, and she works with so many other women in the fellowship. And it's because of people like her that are loving, kind, and patient. But those that are just coming back in or coming in to the fellowship, that we stick and we work the program. There's been a lot of memorable moments of working steps with Kelly. She's given me a lot of love, including some tough love, and that's kept me with you guys today. So round of applause for Kelly's 15th birthday.
Thank you so much, Cleo, and you are such a gift, and one of the many gifts that I've received from this program. And I am so grateful to have found this program, or the program to have found me. I believe the higher power, you know, helped to get me here, and you people help me to stay here, help remind me who I am. Thank you so much, Isla, for your story tonight. You're always such an inspiration to me, and I just love the way you live your life. And thank you. I love this program.
Oh, we love you too, Kelly.
All right. Good job.
Okay. Now, do we have any other anniversaries, birthday? Okay. And there's one last call for the white chip, because we believe in second chances. All right. Thank God and your sponsors for the ships you hold.
Thank you, Cleo. Great job. Next week we have Russell H. of the Toco Group. He's been around since 76, and he's a favorite of my sponsor, Tim M's. Tim M made their arrangements, and I've met Russell on several occasions. He's a wise old guy. Man, he's got something I want. So y'all come back next week.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand and try and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, have some mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its day and the lessons fall apart, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky, till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt? Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.